Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Laura Stark. I'm a professor at Vanderbilt University. I had the great pleasure to talk with Elise Burton about her 2021 book, Genetic Crossroads, The Middle East and the Science of Human Heredity. Elise is assistant professor in the Institute for the History and Philosophy of Science and Technology at University of Toronto. Elise is trained in Middle East area studies, but I got to know her work first as a historian of science. And if you're interested in exploring more of Elise's work, I really admired her 2019 article called Red Crescents, Race, Genetics, and Sickle Cell Disease in the Middle East, which builds on chapter 4 of her book and which appeared in the History of Science journal called ISIS in 2019. Another article, among many others, is Narrating Ethnicity and Diversity in Middle Eastern National Genomics Projects, which appeared in the journal Social Studies of Science in 2018. Elise earned her PhD in history and in Middle Eastern studies from Harvard University and then held a prestigious junior research fellowship at University of Cambridge. At the broadest level, Elise is interested in trans-Asian scientific collaboration and non-European concepts of whiteness and white supremacism. Thanks for listening to our conversation. It was a collaborative interview among Elise, myself, and graduate students in my Vanderbilt seminar on speculative fiction and bioethics called Critical Bioethics. So to start off, I did want to register both our thanks and that we're talking at least on Thursday, April 22nd. So this is the day after the U.S. courts announced the verdict in the trial of the murder of George Floyd. And I just wanted to register that to sort of contextualize for listeners the moment in which we're talking. And also because one way to read this book is as a book about nationalism, which is looking at nationalism through a history of the sciences of heredity. And one of the things that comes through in the book is how race and nation are entirely fused. So it's not like they're working towards the same project, but race and nation are just completely inextricably linked. And it matters for who is seen to belong in public spaces, who is taken to be a legitimate target of violence, whether it's acute or structural violence or even epistemic violence in the sciences. But the center of this story in Genetic Crossroads, the geopolitical center is the Middle Eastern coastline of the Mediterranean Sea, so that we call the Middle East just for ease and shorthand. And this includes the present day countries of Israel, Syria, Iran, Lebanon, Turkey, Greece, and others as well. And the Middle East in this book, it does not function as a case study in the history of heredity, nor does it serve as sort of a periphery to a Euro-American metropole. But instead, what you're doing is you're making the case that Middle Eastern geopolitics have fundamentally structured the modern sciences of heredity. So this history of the Middle East is baked into medical genetics as we know it today and other sciences of heredity, including genetic anthropology, and in the early 19th century, seroanthropology, anthropometry, and other fields as well.
And so you're showing that they are organized around the concepts, materials, and infrastructures that emerge from these precise political, economic, and military sort of violent shifts in 20th century Middle East. Okay, so the book covers a century, basically from the early 19th century to early 20th century to the present day. And it has these three geopolitical inflection points. So these three kind of moments that organize the three sections loosely. The first is the fall of the Ottoman Empire. The second is the aftermath of World War II and practices and discussions around repackaging eugenics and genetics research. And then the reverberations of the Aden Emergency and the Six Days War around the end of the 1960s and into the 1970s. And this is the moment in which Israel just crushed these the Arab forces of Jordan, Syria, and Egypt that fundamentally kind of remapped the Middle East. Okay, so to start at the beginning with these kind of three moments, what do we need to know, big question, about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and why this moment is important for understanding the history of the sciences of heredity?
Yeah, so it's a big question, but I do think it's important to sort of suss out what's going on both politically and scientifically, essentially at the same time. And it might be proper not only to say it's the fall of the Ottoman Empire, but just World War I as a moment generally, because I do think what's going on with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, you're also seeing in terms of the collapse of the Russian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, and so on. So it's not so far removed, of course, from what's going on in Europe, which is more familiar, I'm sure, to some of the listeners out there. So basically, what's happening with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire is you see the hope of the Allied forces. So here, I'm, of course, talking about the British Empire, and the French, and actually at this point, the Italians and the Greeks, they're all looking to actually sort of cut out their own piece of the pie of these former Ottoman territories. So even the country that we now know today as the Republic of Turkey, the Allies were expecting not to let that remain as a freestanding country. They were hoping to carve up even that territory in separate ways, as well as dividing up what we now know as the Arab countries, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, and what would eventually become Israel. All of those borders were drawn in the aftermath of World War I, the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and what was subsequently, you know, what the Turks would call the war for their independence, essentially their national struggle in order to create the borders of what we now know as modern Turkey. So all of that border making, which was done, you know, through violent processes, I'm sure it doesn't need to be said, you know, ongoing war after 1919. So we think of the World War as ending after 1919, but there's ongoing violence for several years in the Middle East after this point. What's happening is you have the mandate system being formed. So Syria and Lebanon were part of what was called the French mandates, and what we now know as Iraq, Jordan, and Palestine, Israel, these were under British mandate control, which was essentially, you know, colonialism under another name. You know, it was sanctioned by the League of Nations. It was allegedly designed to help these new nation states, you know, set up their own governments, but it was designed to prolong and sort of expand, really, European imperial control in the Middle East. At the same time as all of these political machinations are going on, there's a really important new scientific technology being developed to try to do racial categorization. So, of course, as I write about in the first chapter, you already have, since the 19th century, anthropometry. That's something we well know in race science, right? Measurements of human bodies as well as human remains, which is, you know, very pertinent to current events right now. But a major technology that's being developed right at the turn of the 20th century is the discovery of human blood groups. And we are probably familiar with those now, mostly in a medical context, the relevance of the ABO blood groups, later the rhesus blood groups as well, the relevance of those groups for blood transfusion. However, really before the technology of blood transfusion was even perfected, they were already, the scientists who had discovered, had made these discoveries, were already curious as to whether you would see racial differences in the distribution of these, you know, the four blood groups. And so what I write about, again, in the first part of the book is all of these kind of wartime upheavals, the attempt to create new nation states, and more importantly, to create national identities for the people living in those states, is coinciding with new ways of trying to detect race scientifically. So essentially what's happening is the idea of blood as being one's lineage or ancestry is no longer a metaphor. It's actually being turned scientifically into something that's supposed to be able to separate groups into racial and also sort of subracial categories. So I think these are sort of the two things. On the one hand, scientific developments. On the other hand, all of these new political, very complicated things going on, movements of people, right? So at the same time that you're throwing up new political borders, people are being made to inhabit those borders differently. So both of those things are really key to understanding the development of obviously what's going on in the Middle East, but I would say the whole future of genetics as it evolves after that point.
Yeah, so thinking about, as you mentioned, this project of border making as being simultaneously with a project of race making. So after sort of roughly the or during the World War I period, this patchwork of new nations were recognized by groups like the League of Nations. And simultaneously, sort of groups are working to define and delineate race. And so here's what was so interesting in the first section of the book, so chapters 1 and 2, is how things that were cultural markers of difference, like languages, religious groups, sort of tribal histories that were traced to particular Bible stories, came to be organized. These cultural markers were organized under race, the banner of race, which was taken to be a scientific category. So you're showing us how it's important to recognize this direct connection between physical anthropology and what would come to be medical genetics. And so here, I'd love to have Carrie chime in with a really question building off of this.
Yes, thank you so much for that. And also thank you for your time today. So one question that my group and I crafted together is in regards to how does sciences of heredity, such as seroanthropology and other anthropometric methods, continue to perpetuate nationalist projects? And I was wondering if you could speak on that a little bit.
Absolutely. Thank you. So this is a great question because in a way it explains what people have been sort of wrestling with me about this book as to whether or not, you know, national groupings are sort of the same thing as races. In other words, can we talk about race in the Middle East in the same way as we talk about race in other regional or national contexts? And the point that I try to make for why nationalism is an important way for understanding racialization in science is because so much of what was making it possible for scientists to do these studies was having certain kinds of national infrastructures that were not only, you know, supporting this work in any direct material sense, but rather giving a name to different human groups that were being studied. So for example, when we're looking at the anthropometric and seroanthropological studies as they're being done at the beginning of these new nation states that are being created. How are these groups being described? Firstly, using a national marker, and then having identified these different communities that are having their blood sampled or their heads measured. They are then within this national group, not always, depends on the country, but sometimes subdivided in specific categories that are reflecting sort of questions, actually internal tensions over national identity. So for example, in the case of Egypt, which is a country that had already had, perhaps more so than other Arab countries in the Middle East, they had, you know, had a longer sense of kind of a distinct geographic identity, which lent itself well to the creation of like a nation state with particular geographical borders. What was really sort of at the core of national identity debates at this point, you know, we're talking about 1920s, 30s, 40s, is, are the Egyptians Arabs, or are they descendants of the indigenous pharaonic peoples, or are they some kind of mixture? And if they are a mixture, is everybody in Egypt an equal mixture of these two different, you know, nation-defining groups, or are certain religious categories, specifically what they were really interested in studying was the Coptic Christians on the one hand versus Muslims on the other side, and saying, are the Copts, for example, these pure, these racially pure descendants of pharaonic Egyptians, whereas Muslims, because Islam is associated with the coming of you know, the Arab conquest over from the Arabian Peninsula, are Muslims more racially mixed? And therefore, in some way, do they have sort of less of a claim on the pharaonic past of Egypt? So these are questions that are already sort of animating the idea of what is the nation of Egypt? And these are fundamentally questions of ancestry, and they're talked about explicitly at that time and still now in terms of race. And so what these early studies are doing is they are trying to decide sort of these burning questions of political, national, racial identity by doing these studies and trying to see, is there a difference in the frequency of blood groups between Copts and Muslims or not? And these are you know, and the results were hotly debated. So even if one study seemed to come with a clear answer, then another, you know, set of scientists would do a similar study with a bigger sample size or with different antisera and come up with a different answer. And I think the most important thing to understand for why that's ongoing so relevant today is that didn't change after World War II. It didn't change after the development of DNA sequencing. Still, similar studies are going on today. And that's not just a matter for example, the racialization of religious groups in Egypt. It's definitely going on in places like Israel and Palestine, in Lebanon, for example, the idea of ancient Phoenician DNA. Is that something that modern day Lebanese people have? If so, is there more Phoenician DNA in the Muslims in Lebanon or different kinds of Christian groups? So that's being studied even today. It's not something that was only animating people in the pre-war era. It's something that's now trying to be addressed through studies of ancient DNA and the most sophisticated genetic sequencing technologies that we have now. It's still ongoing.
Yeah, so so interesting for both sort of empirical, historical, and also political reasons. You knit and you show so clearly how the sort of colonial infrastructures and the scientific ways of divvying up reputation and authority in the Middle East, coming out of the blood grouping sorts of science, that this then set sort of the groundwork, the physical infrastructural groundwork for traffic in blood samples and storing blood for then what would become medical genetics. and sort of DNA-based genetics. And this chimes with sort of the important work of folks that you're sort of in conversation with in the book, like Jenny Bangham and Joanna Radin. And you specifically use the language of traffic in blood. And so we wanted to have you elaborate a bit on the choice of the word traffic in blood, as opposed to, for example, an exchange or a flow, sort of things that would imply different power relations and colonial relations. So yeah, can you tell us a bit more about the choice of word of traffic in blood?
That's an excellent question. And you know what? No one's ever actually asked me that before. But I think if I can point to sort of two actually very distinct things that definitely influenced me toward coming up with that terminology is actually coursework that I took during my PhD, really on sort of feminist theory and gender studies. And I was definitely very influenced, although I think sort of subconsciously, about using Gail Rubin's concept of the traffic in women, which is, for anyone who hasn't read it here, it's this brilliant essay by a brilliant scholar, Gail Rubin, who actually wrote it, I believe, when she was an undergraduate. So it's this amazing piece of theoretical work for sort of understanding the place of women in society. So she's not only talking like literally about sex trafficking, but just how women are essentially used within broader social relations between men. And so that was something that's definitely sort of underpinning my way of thinking about what it means to be exchanging biological materials here. And another less sort of literal connection, but I think what was more at the forefront of my mind when I was writing this book is debates which are going on in the history of science, and I think also in STS, about the idea of the circulation of both technologies and scientific knowledge. And there have been some very good critiques about, I think, what some people have called hydraulic metaphors or water-based metaphors with circulation or flow. And people have said, well, those terms make it sound as though things are continuous and that there's no sort of barriers to what is moving and when and to whom. And instead, we want a framework that really acknowledges the power relations, most importantly, of who is at the receiving end of the traffic, what is being trafficked, who is kind of letting things stop and go through checkpoints. Also, I mean, if we think of traffic jams, you know, there's all kinds of moments when the normal ways of doing science get stopped for whatever reason, often temporarily, but sometimes permanently. And so even though I didn't really raise that explicitly in the book, now that I'm talking about it with you all, this is definitely something that that I was trying to capture, I think, through my choice of terms there. So thank you. That's a really excellent question.
This is fascinating because I was imagining something along the lines of the engagement with the debates over sort of the hydraulics metaphors, as mm-hmm. you said, and the flows and how that misconstrues what are fundamentally different positions of power that are being studied in the history of science. But this sort of call out to your training in feminist studies and to Gail Rubin is really interesting to see in that way. So building on the idea of kind of unequal quote unquote partnerships, Christina is going to take over with a question.
Thank you, Dr. Stark. Yeah, so some of us wanted to ask you about how old research is often overturned by new scientific findings. That's one of the main points of the second part of your book. And you also explained that, you know, there's this trail of destruction that's often left by these discriminatory findings. So how did anthropologists, along with ethicists, partner with government bureaus in order to reconcile any inequalities that the science did create?
So this is a tough question, and it may be painful to hear. I mean, I think actually in many of the contexts that I wrote about, there hasn't been an appropriate reckoning with the, you know, utter lack of ethics, which underlies the collection of blood or DNA samples from many of the peoples that I've talked about. In terms of how ethicists, I mean, definitely there are, in fact, activists who are trying to work on these issues now. But usually it's within a broader framework of all kinds of rights that are being violated, and not only these sort of past ethical ones. So if we think, for example, the kinds of reckoning that, for example, in North America, that NAGPRA was meant to address, or some of the work that Emma Kowal has done in Australia about Australian Aboriginal blood samples that are now being repatriated. I'm not aware, in the case of a lot of what I've written about, that such things are really on the table. There are probably a few reasons for that. In several of the countries that I'm talking about, it's not clear that a lot of blood samples have in fact actually been preserved. In many cases, they were probably destroyed for various reasons, even after having ended up, for example, in Western laboratories. For example, I know a lot of the samples that were sent to Britain, I believe, have been destroyed without any attempt, you know, to return them to the communities from which they were taken. And the only reason they were destroyed is not for any ethical recognition of the problems of having these samples, but simply they ran out of room in their freezers. You know, it was sort of a very practical reason from sort of a British perspective. And it's really, I think another reason why there hasn't been a lot of attempts yet is actually sort of a lack of recognition of how extensive this research was in the Middle East and how long it's been going on for, and the fact that there was so much of this material actually being sent abroad. And so I'm hoping in a way, like I know, for example, I have students in colleagues who are interested in translating my book into Middle Eastern languages. And so it may be, you know, I do hope that as people in the Middle East become more familiar with this history, that it might advance this as part of an agenda for what several of these groups are trying to do in terms of advocating for their own rights. I mean, I think if I can just pick one example, the group of people that I refer to in the book as Akhdam, who activists would prefer to call themselves Muhammashin, the marginalized. This is the group in Yemen whose ancestry as to whether they were Arab or African was highly disputed, and they have these elevated levels of sickle cell disease in their population. That is a group which is, you know, incredibly marginalized in so many ways that their primary concern is actually not even dealing with this history. In fact, it's probably true that this isn't even on their agenda because they have so many other things that just of basic survival that they need to have first recognized. So I would say that, I'm sorry that might not be a very satisfactory answer to your question, but I think that's part of the reason that at least that I'm not aware of major movements to sort of address these issues in the way that we have seen successfully implemented in the Americas and in Australia.
Yeah. And the example of sickle cell comes up in chapter 4 for folks who want to learn more about it. And it does seem like one of the things the book is showing is that the particular sciences of heredity that are being fostered and supported through these practices of sample collection and storage and trafficking are exactly perpetuating the marginalization of the groups on which they depend. So it's kind of producing this ongoing history and practice of dispossession. But the story is we really appreciate in part because it's not a simple victim villain story where either the scientists are all bad and the research participants are all good, or that there is a clear one side or the other, because so many of the forms of violence and colonialism are nested, or the power is so multifaceted. And one of the examples that kind of gets at this a bit is the story of Bathsheba Bonet and her professional interactions with the British geneticist Arthur Morant. And so I wonder if you could just sort of tell us about this interaction and what it shows us about how things like the changing possession of territory, shifting borders, this precise moment of violence and the effects that it has on who has access to what materials, what we should be taking away from this.
Yeah, so Bathsheba Bonet is one of those really fascinating characters that I came back to over and over, even in other parts of my work, including other articles I've published. And I think what's so appealing about her is, on the one hand, as a historian, she has left the best letters behind in different archives, in which she's extremely expressive about what she's doing. And she also left behind a great autobiography in Hebrew, in which not always consistently, but much more so than many of the other scientists' papers that I was able to get access to sort of explain her feelings and actually like expose more of a rationale for why she was doing things in a certain way. And she's a very complex character. And in some cases, she comes across as very sympathetic, and in others, sort of tone deaf as to what she was doing. So I think that's why she fascinates me a lot as a historian. So if I can sort of very briefly summarize what was an extremely rich and interesting life. So Bathsheba Bonet was part of a family of Ashkenazi, you know, from Germany, who settled in Mandate Palestine before the State of Israel was officially established in 1948. And so she really grew up in what she considered to be this Middle Eastern milieu. She was, you know, a part of a dedicated family of Zionists. So she was definitely attached to that, you know, Israeli nationalism, Jewish nationalism. And what's very interesting about her is that we can clearly recognize that she's part of a settler colonial movement in the Middle East. You know, she came from a family that was, you know, very well educated in Germany. Even within Israel, this particular group of Jewish settlers is known for having like a very kind of European affect and certain patterns of, you know, kind of cultural behavior within Israel. And yet what I try to highlight in my book is the way that she positions herself as being essentially like a native of the Middle East. And so in her relationship with this British geneticist, Arthur Morant, their relationship essentially starts off at odds, and yet it's a very long relationship, you know, for over a decade of her career. She's very academic. She goes through the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and then she goes to the U.S. And it's there that she's trained first in anthropology and then in human genetics. So she also considers herself to sort of be a sensitive ethnographer, which is not something that most of the other geneticists either thought about themselves or considered important to their sort of work of collecting samples. So when she's trying to do her PhD in genetics, She's really keen to do all her work on a particular religious community in Palestine called the Samaritans. And they've been fascinating geneticists already, you know, for decades, because this is a group that had only 100 or a couple hundred members at that point in history. We're talking about the early 1960s right now. And that group claims that actually they're sort of the original Israelites. They're in fact sort of the more authentic representatives of the biblical population of Palestine than any of the Jews who have come to settle in Israel, you know, over the centuries after the diaspora. So they have this claim, you know, this unique claim to being totally indigenous and also very endogamous. You know, they don't allow converts into the community. And they, you know, if anyone married out of the community, they would sort of no longer be considered a Samaritan. So this community is considered extremely desirable, right, for genetic studies. And so Bathsheba Boneh is very excited to be working with this community. She, you know, she sort of already made friends. And she was all set to sort of start doing her dissertation, studying the genetics of this community. And then she suddenly finds out that Arthur Morant, who's this very established senior British guy, who is, you know, collecting blood sort of vicariously, he stays in London most of the time, but he's getting blood samples from all over the world. You know, he doesn't need a big break the way a PhD student might. So there's also that consideration. She finds out when she's trying to get a grant to do her research that this guy, Arthur Morant, you know, through a series of other collaborators, is already planning to go and study the Samaritans. And so, unfortunately, he's the reviewer on her grant application. And so it's like every PhD student's worst nightmare, you know? Anyway, so she's kind of horrified by this discovery, but basically what's offered to her, Morant says, well, I'll basically share this project with you. So I'll go get the blood with a team of people because Bathsheba Boneh herself can't because the community is located across the Green Line. So that's in territory that we now know as the West Bank. At the time, it was considered part of Jordan. So the Samaritans are mostly in the city of Nablus. That's where they are. Boneh is an Israeli citizen. She's not allowed, you know, to cross that border. So in a way, they're making it out to be a situation which will be beneficial for everybody. So Morant and sort of his protege, who's based in Lebanon, and also Bathsheba Boneh's own supervisor, an American guy named William Boyd. These men are going to go off and do the blood collecting. And eventually they'll share some of those blood samples with Boneh, and she'll still get to do her PhD. So that's the solution that's being offered. And Boneh, from the very beginning, is very unhappy with the situation because as they're arranging the expedition, the men are just so convinced that they know exactly what they're doing. They think that all of the arrangements Boneh had tried to make in terms of cultivating a relationship with the community members, they really think that's a liability. And they're like, no, we don't need that. We can just sort of fly in, extract the blood and take off. It's actually not in our interest to compensate these people for the blood they're giving. You know, they don't want entanglements. You know, that's definitely kind of the ethos of a lot of geneticists in this period. And so then what happens is when they actually go on this expedition to Nablus and try to extract the blood, they run into all kinds of problems. And in the end, they're only able to sample, I think, maybe a third or a quarter of the community's members. And Boneh is like, well, you guys ruined it. You ruined my project. If you had listened to me, or if you know, let me take more of a leading role in communicating with the members of the community, then things would have gone better. And she specifically writes in this letter to Morant, you know, being from the Middle East, I can perceive very clearly, you know, what's gone wrong. That's essentially what she writes in her letter. And so then you're like, oh, well, what does she mean that she's from the Middle East? You know, she's not a Samaritan. She doesn't belong to the community. So on what basis is she sort of claiming a certain kind of legitimacy that that these white guys don't have, right? And this actually forms the interesting basis of like a lot of her conflicts with Morant that persist over the years, even as borders start shifting, right? As you said, in response to all of the military things that are happening. So I don't know how long I should go on with just sort of explaining the outlines of the story, but basically like it's one thing that she maintains consistently whenever there's a problem with other populations as well, not only the Samaritans, but other groups she works on, like the Bedouins of Sinai, which is a territory that comes to be occupied by Israel. She claims, on the one hand, I'm from the Middle East, and also I'm an anthropologist, and I know better than you sort of how to sample these people and how to interpret the data. So she claims her identity, both professional and sort of where she was raised, as being the basis for sort of her legitimacy as a scientist. And she's trying to leverage that against these older, senior British and American men who are otherwise kind of dismissing her role in the genetics work.
Your analysis of this, I think in chapter 6, is so interesting because it fits in with this history of who's considered sort of a technician and who is an authoritative knower. And what you're showing is it actually tacks sort of occupying forces and military sort of interventions to scientific reputation. So when she can have access, exclusive access to these populations and these samples because of these identity-based claims that she's making, it actually shifts how she's understood in terms of her scientific reputation and also her scientific status. Meanwhile, all the Arab communities that are involved in the research, all of the scientists are just considering it on a model of resource extraction, of just coming in and getting and using the resource, which is also so interesting in seeing that similarity between Bathsheba Bonnet and Arthur Morant. So it's really interesting. And building on this idea of sort of who is a technician and who is a sort of a scientific status holding knower, and also thinking about collection methods more broadly, Lily wanted to ask a question on behalf of her group.
Yes. So we kind of read the book, and in the book you talked a lot about the different kinds of research and data collection methods in the time period you were researching. But we were wondering, how have the research and data collection methods changed going into the 21st century, especially when looking at modern day projects that you mentioned in the conclusions, like the genographic project and modern day research in Turkey and Iran?
Okay, so I think in terms of the major changes that are happening, especially once we get to the 21st century, the main one is actually bureaucratic. And that is now these scientists are expected to have attained some kind of ethical approval from some sort of institutional review board. And the other one, sort of depending on what the scientists are trying to study, is sometimes they're no longer taking blood, although blood collection does still happen. Sometimes it is done through something like a saliva sample or a buccal swab or something that's considered to be sort of less invasive, right, than blood drawing. So that's one of the technological changes. I guess I would want to comment more on the question of these IRB, these ethical reviews, and whether or not they have substantially changed things. This is something I wrestle with a little bit at the end, I think, of chapter 7, actually. And I felt it was important to raise this issue because on the one hand, we now insist that anyone whose sample is collected has to give their informed consent, right? And usually this would mean signing some kind of form. And the idea is that simply by having the person give informed consent in whatever form that the IRB has deemed acceptable or necessary, that this is somehow doing away with a large amount of the ethical problems that I've talked about in the book. And my contention is I don't actually think that this is addressing the key problem of how this kind of genetic data is interpreted and used, and then how it gets filtered out into the social world, both in the Middle Eastern context specifically, and then the wider world more broadly. And the reason I'm saying this is, so the specific incident I mentioned at the end of chapter 7 is how, for example, refugees of the recent military, you know, very violent ethnic cleansing that was done by ISIS in northern Iraq against, for example, Yazidis and Assyrians. And so those groups that were targeted already specifically for their, you know, ancestral religious cultural identities ended up in these refugee camps. And then study, you know, geneticists came in for various reasons. A lot of it was to do to try to actually do forensic related genetic studies that could help, you know, identify remains, you know, of the victims of this violence, and, you know, hopefully reunite remains with families and so on. So there's not solely nefarious reasons for this genetic work, as I want to make clear. And so I can imagine that many of the refugees gave consent on this basis, that, you know, having their DNA sequenced would, you know, help them find out what happened to their family members. But then that data was also used to do a population genetic analysis, which was made to say something about the ancestry and indigeneity of these people as well. So basically a paper was published saying, oh, you know, the lineages of these people are shown, you know, to be very ancient, and basically reinforcing the idea that the DNA of these people is identifiable in terms of a population group that could be associated with certain kinds of historical identities, biological grouping. So it's not just a family or individuals whose relations are being identified, but rather that you could in fact mark out this group using their DNA. So I think there's danger to that kind of work, especially in as far as how it might later be used, you know, hopefully not to further target these people, but we don't know what the long-term effects of that kind of work is. And I think another thing that I raised briefly in the conclusion to sort of reinforce the dangers of that kind of work is how Jews and Palestinians, who are some of the most genetically studied groups in the world at this point, I believe some psychologists, right, did a study with Jewish people living both in Israel and I believe also in the United States. And they were made to sort of read some article saying something about how closely related Jews and Palestinians are or are not, and how the reading of that kind of material about either being genetically related or unrelated then affected how these different Jewish people thought about the Palestinian conflict and the treatment of Palestinians. So the idea of genetic relatedness is not just this total abstraction, this sort of academic debate of finding out who's related to who, you know, in the terms of DNA sequencing. Like it has, we know that it can have real world impacts. And in a region which is still, you know, threatened by all kinds of territorial violence, and the territorial violence is justified on the basis of different kinds of competing national identities and claims related to religion or other kinds of social differences. I don't think that the use of, you know, IRB, informed consent, is really going to solve what is the core ongoing problem, the way that this research is ultimately going to be taken up by communities in the region. So that's sort of maybe going aside from what you thought the answer to this question was going to be. But thank you very much for raising it.
Observations about how IRBs are sort of used and the sort of the American concept of both bioethics and informed consent is sort of appropriated in order to actually foster medical research that actually produces a lot of dispossession and discrimination. It inflects a lot with Adriana Petrena's work, I feel like, on ethical variability. So this appropriation of what are seemingly morally upstanding practices to actually underwrite things that are very contrary to the alleged aim of moral principles. And your comments also inflect with Kim Tallbearer's work, I feel like, on epistemic violence and indigeneity, and thinking about your book showing so nicely exactly how this, the ways in which genetic materials, genetic stories are interpreted and used can really affect, you know, sovereignty claims, actual settler violence and other forms of marginalization. And so I think just to sort of wrap up, just to say that this story in Genetic Crossroads is basically revealing the assumptions that are built into sciences of heredity in the present day. And so sort of on this note, we kind of wondered whether there's anything, any puzzles that are kind of left lingering for you and maybe what's exciting you right now. So I'm gonna hand it over to Olivia for this one.
Sure, so as you kind of gleaned from our workshopping of our questions, we were trying to situate your scholarship and the book within your scholarship. And so earlier you mentioned your encounter with Middle Eastern histories and sciences of heredity. And we were wondering how you're going to kind of pivot from this work into new projects that maintain the same trajectory that you have with Genetic Crossroads.
Thank you. This is a great question because it lets me talk about my new project, which I'm at very early stages, but extremely excited about. So I think you are probably understanding that when I wrote about race in the book, in a lot of ways, it's reaching toward sort of a history of maybe non-European whiteness, because I talked about the racialization of a lot of different groups, but most of them would have still been considered in these kind of international conceptualizations of broad racial categories to still sort of count as white. And there were only a few sort of exceptional groups who were racialized in different ways as being either of African descent and also, although they didn't come up as often, of Asian descent. And so when we're talking about a region, which if, you know, if we jettison the colonial term, the Middle East, which I've talked about this region, and think about it as actually being Southwest Asia, which, I mean, technically, if we're going strictly in terms of directional geography, that's really what it is. I became interested in sort of what were my blind spots while writing this book and focusing on this relationship solely of the Middle East to Europe and North America, and thinking about it only as part of those scientific circuits. Like, obviously I had a reason for that, and it was to prove to people who do Eurocentric histories of science that this region is relevant to the histories that they know and write. But I thought to myself, how is it that we can only write about other regions and their histories in relation, you know, to this sort of North Atlantic center? And so now I've started off in this project, which will continue looking at race and genetics, but it will also pick up on archaeology and forensic fingerprinting. So it will, those are the scientific areas it looks at. But my main focus is trying to look at collaborations between Middle Eastern scientists, especially Iranians and Turkish scientists, and their collaborations with scientists in India and Japan. So I'm really interested in looking at what I'm sort of calling trans-Asian scientific collaborations. And it's something I stumbled across really by accident, because when I was looking at the history of genetics in Iran, I came across this whole expedition that happened in the 1970s, where these Japanese scientists came to northern Iran and did a whole bunch of sampling. And they were, you know, apparently working in collaboration with a few Iranian scientists. And then when I was reading sort of the output of that, the scientific papers that came out, it was very clear that what was being authored only by the Japanese scientists had a very different tone about the racial identity of the people they studied, who they were calling, you know, partially Mongoloid. These were the terms they were using, versus what the Iranian scientists were putting out, which is, you'll have seen the language in my book. The Iranians said, no, these people are Aryans. You know, they're white, they're Caucasoid. And so that sort of launched me in this other direction. Like, what if we consider the history of genetics in the Middle East as part of this history of Asian histories of racial identity and racialization. And so that's sort of underlying, that's like the big framing question for this next project that I'm hoping to do.
Super fascinating. Well, we have a lot to look forward to then, with sort of a history working towards ideas of non-European whiteness, and also this idea of trans-Asian histories and trans-Asian histories of science. Elise, thank you so much both for your time and for a really fantastic book. We're really grateful to you.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks to all of your students who came up with such terrific questions. I really appreciate having this conversation with you.